Good morning and hello again. Today, advice on minding yourself from geriatrician Dr. Des O'Neill. Also, how to unpack your shopping safely. News of a new smartphone app to facilitate contact tracing. Also, direct to the graveyard. Funeral service later, we talk to Bishop Larry Duffy. How people actually behave during shutdowns. MABS, the money advice and budgeting service on spending wisely. Brian reports on pharmacies dealing with extra demand. Eamon Ryan on government formation. And Brian Redden and Aoife Barry on staying entertained through the crisis. Email today sor at rte.ie, text us on 51551, and you can also tweet at today sor. Well, as we've been hearing, projections this morning tell us that more than 500 people could be in need of intensive care every day by mid-April. So the need to find and isolate cases of COVID-19 is growing ever more urgent. That's something which we will be returning to throughout today's programme. Now, also, according to guidelines released by the HSE, cocooning is a measure to protect people over 70 and also people with extreme medical, who are extremely medically vulnerable. And the idea is that they minimise interaction between themselves and other people. It means that those who fall into that category should not leave their homes, and within their homes they should minimise all non-essential contact with other members of their household. On the line now, a consultant geriatrician in Talla University Hospital, Professor Des O'Neill. Good morning to you, Des. Thanks for coming on the programme again. It would have been a very, I suppose, worrying announcement by the Taoiseach for many people over 70 when they watched him on Friday evening at 8:30 or thereabouts. How important is it, though, for people who fall into this category to adhere closely to the advice?
Sure. I think to the greatest extent possible, it is important. I mean, it really is, I suppose, quite a shock to many people in the younger, older category. Irish people have been getting healthier and living longer lives. We see, for example, over in the US, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the very expert medical advisor to Trump. Well, he's 79. But in general, I think in terms of the overall population and in terms of themselves, I think it is really important that people adhere to these guidelines to the greatest extent possible. This is a condition that you're not at greater risk of getting it if you're older, but you're at greater risk of a more severe illness, because generally we have somewhat less reserve, we tend to perhaps have more conditions, and you're more likely to die should you get it. Now, again, the vast majority of older people will survive, but there are particular, so this is something that really people should try and row into. That being said, I think these guidelines, you know, the team involved, the public servants involved here have been phenomenal in what they've pulled together in a short period of time. I think the one area that needs to be teased out in a second version of this document is the issue for people with significant cognitive impairment or dementia. The guidelines are very good about providing physical care, you know, if you've got to help somebody out of bed, if you've got to help them with continence, but I think there can be significant psychological, social, emotional distress for people with dementia, and I think we need to think about some common sense around how we engage here. So we've understood that for physical needs, there will need to be closer contact and precautions, and I think for significant distress arising with dementia, hopefully within the next week or so, we'll begin to get a better grasp.
What are the gaps that need to be filled in there, then, in your view?
First of all, again, if there's anything that I don't wish to sound in any way critical of what's been pulled together, and it is an iterative process, and people have been working really, really well together. I think that there needs to be a clearer advice on those with distress arising, particularly from moderate to severe dementia, so that that need can be catered for. There will be a degree of risk. We've got to remember this is...
Direct and face-to-face contact and close contact like that?
Well, it may end up being that with the degree of risk. And I think, again, hopefully the HPSC and the Clinical Advisory Group for Older People can now start working on some type of guidance in this area here. We've got to bear in mind that these restrictions are based on societal consent and personal consent. And again, this consent may not be at all clear to somebody who has significant dementia.
Sure. And now, one other thing I wanted to ask you about was just the idea of confining people who either are healthy or who are recovering from an illness, confining to their own house or garden or apartment. People for whom a daily walk is an essential part of their mental and physical well-being. They can't do that now. Why?
Yeah, well, it's because of effectively contact with other surfaces and areas. For example, if you ended up in a shop or, you know, touching things, or indeed contact with the rest of the population. I mean, these things often seem arbitrary in the way, for example, that 18 for voting is arbitrary, or that, you know, 67 for a bus pass or a pension is arbitrary. But actually, at some stage, you've got to draw a line. So I think it is important that fitter, younger, older people provide example. But I think there's a couple of things that could be done. And one of them is, I do think that although many older people are tech savvy, many are not. And I think RTE should, as the main public service broadcaster, should look towards twice daily exercise on the television, for example, ideally with an organization like Age and Opportunity, who have their Go for Life program, which allows for exercise in a chair. So again, it's to use the space that you have available to you. And this would create a sense of community if, say, at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock every day, there was an exercise program, an advisory program, perhaps also a program that said, well, look, you have a smartphone or an iPad. Here you are, and this is how you link up. I think consideration of provision of dongles for people who perhaps just had an iPhone and that, but they can't.
Yes.
I think there are things that could be done.
Is there any reason why a farmer in his or her 70s shouldn't go out and walk their land?
Oh, I think there should. As I read the guidelines, their land is their land. So, I mean, that's part of their house and land. I mean, if it's adjoining their house, it's effectively part of their land.
Yes, or even if somebody can go for a walk up the hill behind the house, they may not own it, but it could be, you know, a public area. And they're not going to be going into shops. I mean, I think people get that, the idea of staying away from shops or from areas where people congregate. But, you know, in the open country.
Yeah, well, except I suppose the problem is we saw a little bit what happened in the open country up in the Dublin and Wicklow mountains. I suppose there has to be common sense here, and if there's a bit of common land that absolutely nobody else is using, I think, you know, it's hard to imagine that is going to be policed in its own right. But I think it's important that we try to share a certain set of behaviours among ourselves, and it's access to these areas generally is but through paths or fences or gates, that sort of thing. So I think forbearance for at least a fortnight here is important. I think my concerns are less around somebody who wants to walk up a bit of a mountain and more that we develop guidelines for those who have dementia.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. That's Professor Des O'Neill, consultant geriatrician at Tally University Hospital. I want to talk to Professor Paul Moynan now. He is Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University. Paul, thank you indeed for coming on. We've heard about projections this morning telling us that more than 500 people could be in need of intensive care every day by mid-April. So clearly, as we say, the need to find and isolate cases of COVID-19 is growing ever more urgent. Now, I suppose a lot depends on the kind of modelling that's done and certain assumptions that might have led to that figure or projection may well have changed. And also, we've seen the numbers that have been coming out. They're well below what the Taoiseach speculated on or suggested would be the 15,000 cases by the end of the month. So what's your view as to how things need to progress at this stage?
I think first thing to say, Sean, is that testing is very, very important, and you can see lots of evidence for that. So even in terms of the WHO and the Director General of WHO, he basically said that every positive test is going to help in terms of reducing the spread of this virus. So I think we really need to focus on testing, trying to maximise the level of testing that we're doing. I should say that I think the testing centres are doing a really, really good job at the moment under extreme circumstances.
But there seems to be a shortage of equipment.
There seems to be a shortage of equipment. And I think one of the things we need to try to find out is to find out where the bottlenecks actually are. I've heard a number of potential reasons in terms of the limitations that's reducing the rate of testing. But I think one of the things we need to do is to find out in sort of a very coordinated way where the bottlenecks are, and then basically look at every resource at our disposal in terms of addressing those bottlenecks.
Yes, because, for instance, 10 days ago we were being told that the testing rate would be up very quickly to 15,000 per day, but we heard Anne O'Connor from the HSE this morning saying there would be a shortfall today, but there would be back up towards 5,000 a day, within days as the kits, the testing kits became available. So I personally am confused about what's supposed to be going on and what is going on.
So I think some clarity is certainly required there, Sean, in terms of, because in order to identify what the problem is and then look at ways of addressing that. I absolutely agree. Scaling of testing, I think, should be one of the top priorities, especially over the next 4 weeks. I think we have a very narrow window to have a very significant effect in terms of curtailing the spread of infection. Because over the next 4 weeks, I would say we'll probably reach the peak of infection over that time period. So we have a short number of weeks now in which we can have some control in terms of how high that peak is, and I think testing is at the centre of that.
Yes, and indeed there would be grounds for hope if you take some of the figures we've seen by way of the increases. For instance, on Saturday the number of cases rose by 14%, yesterday 8%. They would be well below the projections that were put forward, but of course without knowing whether the level of testing is sufficient, figures like that, they don't tell you as much as perhaps you would like to know.
Yeah, I've some sort of probably questions and concerns around that, Sean. So one is in terms of the scale of testing. So certainly we know it would be really good in terms of the number of tests per day, but also in terms of the speed of testing. I think that's a critical factor. So, and there's two components there. First of all, the time taken between requesting of a test and sampling, because if that is slow, the test we currently use at the moment, the virus may be gone. And secondly, the time from sampling, the sample is actually taken from the individual to testing. If that is slow, then our daily rate data is potentially out of date by a number of days and maybe up to a week. So I think we need to be very careful here. And again, data around that in terms of how quickly samples are being processed is very, very important in terms of getting a picture of the real-time scenario.
And in an ideal world, would testing be extended to everybody in the community?
Yeah, I think ideally, I think that should be our ambition. I think we should look over time to get to mass scale testing at the population level. I don't think that's possible with our current test. Our current test now is extremely valuable. In my view, it's the test that we should be using presently. So it's a PCR-based test that actually directly detects the virus. The big advantage of this, it detects very early infection. But I think over time, there's great value in you moving to what we refer to as serological testing, and that's based on detecting antibodies in the blood. Again, it's my understanding, I think the HSE has ordered some of these serological tests in. Initially, I think they should be prioritised for healthcare workers, especially because what it tells us is that somebody has been infected, but also that somebody has generated antibodies against the virus and then presumably is immune to the virus and then probably can return to work in a safe manner. I think over time, the serological tests offer us a way to go to mass testing. But again, they need to be tested. You're probably familiar with the UK in terms of the UK has bought a number of these kits, but I think they have to be tested robustly, both in terms of specificity to make sure that they're only picking up the coronavirus, but also in terms of sensitivity, because the antibodies are really only produced maybe as early as 7 days, up to 10, 12 days. So if you're trying to detect early infection, I think the PCR test that we're using currently is the better approach. But for later infections and in terms of especially capturing the level of immunity in the population, the serological test
and of course,
is majorly beneficial.
Quick turnaround is vital there.
Absolutely.
Is there more that could be done, given we have a massive biopharma industry in this country, to speed up that?
But I think the immediate discussion should take place. I think an action plan is absolutely immediately required. So in terms of, as I said previously, Sean, I think we need to identify and absolutely be clear in terms of where the bottlenecks are and then use all our resources and expertise. So if you look, for example, in universities, and I previously articulated this, in the universities at the moment, we've got the best equipped labs, some of the best researchers in the world that are using this technology sort of on a daily basis. Is it possible to use that expertise, to use those labs, maybe even as satellite testing centres, but to use some of that expertise from those scientists and actually get around those bottlenecks. But also, as you said, also interface with, biopharma sector. So if you look at the biopharma sector, they have much experience in terms of, how to scale protocols, standards, accreditation. But the bottom line here, Sean, is I would emphasize is time. Our biggest enemy as well as the virus is time. Because for a virus that's exponentially spreading, like every day is absolutely crucial. So I think this needs to be addressed absolutely as with top priority. But I think by getting all of the resources, all of that expertise, all of that advice together, I think we can at least explore the opportunity if we can do more.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. That's Paul Moynagh there, Professor of Immunology, and he's also Director of the Human Health Research Institute at Maynooth University. By the way, about cocooning, Janet, who describes herself as an elderly ex-health worker, says on cocooning, Sean, what is wrong with us? I am just sick listening to people who want themselves to be the exception to the general advice, while my health colleagues are putting their own lives at risk to treat these very people who just don't want to be discommoded even for a short time. Keep those texts coming. 51551. I'm joined on the line by Dara O'Brien. He is Managing Director of Castlebridge Data Protection Consultancy. Dara, we've been seeing and reading reports that the HSE expects a smartphone app to facilitate contact tracing, that smartphone app to be rolled out in the next 10 days. How would such an app work, and what kind of precise information would it be able to give us access to?
Well, Sean, there's a couple of ways in which an app like that would work, and there are a couple of instances of apps like that in different countries around the world, Singapore being the most high-profile one at the moment. And they would use data either from your mobile phone and its location derived from the mobile network, or the way Singapore is doing it, it's not looking at your location, it's looking at your distance from people and how long you are in proximity to them, derived from the Bluetooth on your phone. So the thing that allows you to connect your wireless headphones or your car to your phone, it's using that signaling technology. And in terms of other data, depending on how the app is designed, it can ask for data or it can request data from you in terms of asking you specific questions.
Yes, but essentially, does it warn people or let them know that there are cases or perhaps clusters close to where they are?
Well, this is the difference between contact tracing app and notification. Singapore's app doesn't tell people that there is someone near them. It allows contact tracers to contact individuals and follow up with them. There are some app. There's one app I've looked at in the last couple of days in another EU country that is doing push notifications like that. But the question I would ask is, what's the purpose and what's the benefit? And also, what's the possible downside of sending push notifications to people who might be somewhat distressed, etc., when they get that information? We can't forget the importance of the human touch here and supporting existing contact tracing processes rather than necessarily replacing them. We have systems that work and work well, but we need to be ensuring that we're supporting those, not necessarily replacing them in their entirety with a new and innovative technology that's being introduced at pace.
Now, I gather you think that there are data protection concerns we should be cognizant of, but again, I suppose the question is one of balance, those concerns versus the crisis that we're dealing with.
Well, it is always a question of balance. Data protection is the counterpoint on a number of things, but it's not just me who's raising the questions of balance or other people in data protection world raising the questions of balance. Michael Ryan from the World Health Organization was quite explicit the other night in his press conference on the importance of ensuring that the implementation of new technologies to support the response to COVID-19 is done with an appropriate respect and appropriate awareness of data protection and other fundamental rights. Also, if we implement these sorts of technologies, it's important for the state and agencies introducing these types of technologies to be aware of and consider those issues, because if they don't, that will affect the uptake, because what we're trying to deal with here is trust. We're trying to encourage people to trust the app, to trust the data collection
and
that's going on.
Is it clear from what's been said or indicated by the HSE in this country what exactly would be the use made of such an app?
To be honest with you, Sean, no, because yesterday it came out in the press conference that they were looking to use the app to gather epidemiological and symptom information from people who have tested positive. Now, There's no issue with that. My concern is trying to do multiple things in the one app when they're trying to deliver the app in a short period of time. There's a phrase in the IT world, minimum viable product. You identify what's the most important requirement, and you deliver that first and deliver that well, and then you bring in the other functionality separately later in the process. So at this point, it's either a contact tracing app or it's a contact tracing to symptom management app, or it's gathering information for epidemiological research later. There's a little bit of lack of clarity there, and it's important that that is clarified to make sure that people understand that when they use the app, what will happen with their data, how long it will be retained for, and who it will be shared with.
Dara, thank you very much indeed for coming on the line. That's Dara O'Brien there. He is Managing Director of Castlebridge Data Protection Consultancy. Now, among the guidelines issued to clergy and parishes in the Catholic Diocese of Clogher in recent days by Bishop Larry Duffy was that for all funerals, the funeral mass will be celebrated at a later date when this crisis has passed. Consequently, for now, the body of the deceased will be brought directly to the place of burial. The rite of committal or burial will be led by a priest, deacon, or if necessary, a lay person. Bishop Larry Duffy is on the line. Good morning to Dr. Duffy.
Good morning, Sean.
And thank you for coming on the programme. Just for people who don't understand, what geographical part of the country is covered by the Diocese of Clogher?
The Diocese of Clogher is a cross-border diocese. We have almost all of County Fermanagh, some of County Tyrone. We go as far as Bundoran up north and by and large all of County Monaghan. So it's and maybe one even or two townlands in County Louth. So it goes right across the country and across the border.
Very much so. Now, what led you to issue these guidelines, which obviously will be very saddening, I suppose, for a lot of people? And you would have done it, I would have thought, with a heavy heart.
Without doubt. We're in very different times at the moment. 3 weeks or even a month ago, I could not have imagined that we would be in the situation we're in now, with so many people's lives affected and their routine disturbed and changed. When the Taoiseach spoke on Friday and after the British Prime Minister had spoken earlier in the week, the general theme was stay indoors. Look after yourself, particularly if you're aged. And I went and looked at the age profile of the priests of Clogher. And almost half of them were in the over 70 or with people with underlying health difficulties. About a third of the parishes then had no priest other than one who was asked to stay at home. So in the circumstances, I felt, and in terms of care for people and trying to not have crowds together, this was the wisest thing to do. And I felt it was the responsible thing to do, however difficult, and it is very difficult. I had consulted with a good number of priests and with a number of lay people. And while we all know that in Irish society, a funeral is so important, and even the encouragement and the support that people get from their neighbours and friends, it's so important. But even that had disappeared in the last week or two, because many wakes were being cancelled. And indeed, some people were already going straight for burial, however few. So we felt out of care for both priests and people that we had to make this difficult decision. And that's what we decided to do.
Yeah, it's probably about 3 weeks ago. In fact, we had an undertaker, a representative on the programme, and who was outlining a process that you've just explained is necessary. And I personally was a bit incredulous that it would come to this, but clearly it has. And from talking to your fellow bishops or your bishop colleagues, is something similar happening, or do you expect it to happen in a lot of other dioceses?
Well, Every bishop looks at his own situation, and each diocese is different. And the regulations that we put out are for Clogher, and Clogher only at the moment. And every bishop will have to make his own decision, and he may see it differently. And maybe when he looks at the number of priests and what's available, it can be different. But I would feel that it's also an effort to lessen the number of people who are going to be invited out into the public space. And it's very difficult to cancel the funeral and to postpone it for maybe 3 months. Who knows what length of time. But that is very difficult.
And
I feel it's the right thing for me to do at this time.
What's happening in some situations or circumstances is that funeral masses take place with obviously the deceased present in the church, and a small number of family or close connections, maybe 15, 20 people. That can't happen any longer.
That can't happen. What will happen when the family of the deceased approach the priest? The priest will let them know that in the present circumstances, however difficult this is, that there is no funeral mass. But the priest can offer to offer a private mass for the deceased and the family, and offer that the funeral celebration can take place later after this period of time is over. And we don't know how long that will be.
And also in your guidelines, baptisms and marriage ceremonies are also cancelled or postponed. But you have advice for parents maybe who are waiting for a child who is sick to be baptised?
Well, I would say almost for any child. I would know of one instance where the parish secretary rang a number of people who had arranged baptisms and felt that the numbers coming to the church would be above what was recommended, and she suggested to them that they postpone the baptism, and they said, "We are so relieved, because we were even thinking of approaching you ourselves, but we didn't like to do it, having booked the baptism." So they were cancelled for the moment, and they were very happy with that. So in cases like that, in the normal routine case, we would be saying that a priest can bestow a blessing over the phone on the child, and that parents can bless their own child. And in an emergency, of course, the child can be baptized by lay people just by pouring the holy water and saying the required prayers, which can be done. And obviously that would be the advice given by a priest should a circumstance arise like that.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Bishop Larry Duffy on the line there, the Bishop of Clogher, which, as he was explaining to us, covers quite a stretch along the border from County Louth up to County Donegal. Now, I am joined by our Midlands correspondent, Ciarán Mullooly. Ciarán, you've got a story about the kind of grief and extra sadness and the burden. In fact, it's doubly so in a story you've come across in your region.
Yeah, Sean, these are extraordinary times, and they are extraordinarily difficult times for everybody, particularly, of course, somebody who loses somebody when a death takes place in the house, whether it's related to coronavirus or not. And many of these incidents I've heard about in the last few days are not related. You know, there's an issue with regard, I suppose, to how people in the extended family and in the community are trying to support those who are bereaved, trying to come forward with support and assistance. So last night, I got a call from a relative of a couple in the Midlands. We'll leave it at that for the moment, because this is a private matter for them today. But the issue being raised by the relative was very straightforward. They felt, firstly, they had been told very clearly that they would not be in a position to attend the funerals which are taking place this week. And they were told that in the circumstances, there would be one funeral when the man involved would be buried. The relatives will be invited to the gravesite at a particular time, and that will take place over a very short 15-minute period. Then they were told that a matter of hours later, the woman would be brought to the same grave, and she would be interred at that time in the presence of a small number of people. Now, the relative involved was deeply distressed by all of this. First and foremostly, out of a concern for the family involved, they wanted to be there at their side, such a traumatic situation with a man and a woman both passing away. And they wanted to be at their side, and they wanted to provide support and assistance. But they were told clearly that within the guidelines, that's not possible anymore. And the message that I was asked to put out today was to, there's an ironic twist to this. They said, look at the isolation of that graveyard and what's happening at the moment. And look at the isolation that is required in a widespread basis within community to try and stop the virus from spreading. They're making the point, particularly about urban areas, where they still feel not enough is being done, that people are still not doing enough to stop the spread. But there's a wider point as well, Sean, just if I can mention it briefly, with regard to support and the grieving process. In recent days, I'm sure you've had this yourself, and many of your listeners will have felt so inadequate when they've heard of a death, perhaps a tragic passing. And in particular, I'm going to mention two deaths in recent recent days, because they have been raised publicly by members of the family online in recent days. And the inadequacy of the community is coming forward because people want to be there, as they have been doing for generations, supporting people. So two deaths in recent times. As I say, the families involved have spoken about these in the community. A tragedy last week in Clara in County Offaly, where a 14-year-old girl was killed in a car accident. Aoife Doyle Scully, beloved young girl, killed in an accident. Tragedy, a huge tragedy for her parents, Una and Damien. And the community wanted to come out and support her. What they did do in that circumstance as well, fortunately, they were fortunate, I suppose, at that time that the event could be somewhat public. And the event, there was a funeral mass. It was in the church in the little town of Clara and was broadcast on YouTube. Aoife's uncle Ronan taking measures to ensure that somebody in the community and wider area could be part of that grieving process. That's what they wanted the community to do, and that's what the community did with some pride in Clara. Now, contrast that what's happened at the weekend in County Roscommon, a young footballer, Conor Kennelly, in his 40s, died tragically on Saturday morning, out jogging on Saturday morning when he collapsed. And, you know, the amount of grief that is raised, first and foremost, of course, for his wife, Claire, and his three young children. But the wider family, and his brother speaking at the weekend on social media about this as well. And how are the community reacting this time? They cannot do anything. They've been leaving flags for their county outside their matches, outside their homes over the weekend. The Roscommon colours and indeed the Ballycumber colours in Offaly, where Conor lived, going out there. So great difficulties for people trying to come to grips with this issue of not being able to be personal in their expression of grief.
Okay, Kieran, it brings it home, those two stories particularly, and also the couple that you were telling us about. It really is a tough time, and our thoughts and sympathies are very much with those families. Kieran Mullooly, our Midlands correspondent, thank you indeed. News just in that Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief advisor in 10 Downing Street, Boris Johnson's chief advisor, has reportedly got the coronavirus and has been showing symptoms of same. More about that a little later. We'll be talking to Eamon Ryan about government formation in this country after the break.